This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Elder abuse is a national problem affecting more than 2 million older Americans, 21,000 in North Carolina last year alone. Abuse can range from physical to emotional, even financial, but community organizations are responding, and so is Governor McCrory. He has declared this Vulnerable and Elder Abuse Awareness Month. Today, we look into the problem, at why it's happening, who is committing these acts, and what we can do to both spot it and stop it. We're joined by Kathy Maurer, Adult and Aging Services Program Administrator at the Cabarrus County Department of Human Services. Thanks for driving down from Cabarrus County today. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Lori Abinader is Regional Ombudsman. Regional Ombudsman with the Central Ina Area Agency on Aging. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Shazia Keller has been a staff attorney at Legal Aid of North Carolina for almost 8 years. Her work focuses on assisting clients with advanced directives, estate planning matters, and other elder law issues. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having us.
It's a big country, and although 2 million elder adults reportedly being abused sounds terrible, and it's not excusable in any way, it's a big country. 2 million sounds like a small number in this country, and 21,000 in North Carolina does as well. So put those numbers into perspective for me.
Well, basically, in Cabarrus County, year to date through May, we had a total of 905 Adult Protective Services reports. Those are just actually the reports of citizens that having concerns about someone being abused, neglected, or exploited. And we did substantiate 230 of those. What substantiates means is that we did find that abuse, neglect, and exploitation had taken place. So that gives us a little idea of what some of the numbers are in Cabarrus County. Mm-hmm. Of course, when you move to larger populated areas like Mecklenburg, those numbers, I'm sure, would increase.
Lori, you're shaking your head, nodding your head vigorously there. I would say the numbers are larger, right?
The numbers are larger. The information that we hear about elder abuse is that it is a grossly hidden problem, and the estimates are that for every one that actually is reported, that up to five more cases of elder abuse are happening that are not being reported, all the way up to 23. And because it's such an underreported issue, what we know is that this is the tip of the iceberg, okay, what's actually being reported.
Shazia, you're an attorney, so I'm going to ask the attorney to define what we're talking about here. What is elder abuse? What constitutes it?
Elder abuse is generally defined as when a senior is somehow, in layman terms, exploited or taken advantage of, whether it be financially, physically, sexually, and it also encompasses self-neglect, which is maybe there's no third person inflicting any sort of wrongdoing, but an elder, due to different issues with aging, is just not keeping up with things that you and I take for granted, whether it be hygiene, whether it be cooking and eating, or whether it be keeping up with medications and food and treatments and doctor's appointments. It can be a wide variety of issues.
And when a person themselves is responsible for their own neglect, is someone else to blame for that, or is that simply something that you want to look into because they are hurting themselves because they can't take care of themselves?
I don't know if we want to say someone else is to blame, but I think the reason that we're all here and this is, you know, an issue that's getting so much attention is because I think we all need to take a little bit of interest and responsibility for our friends and neighbors and loved ones and avoid small issues magnifying and spinning out of control and becoming, you know, if it's self-neglect or a minor issue, if someone, for example, is exploited financially, that will often cascade into health issues and other issues. So
When abuse is being perpetrated by a third party, a second person outside by someone else, is it being done out of frustration on the part of a caregiver, perhaps, because caregiving is extremely consuming, or is it being done most often with malice, deliberately to take advantage of another human being?
I think what occurs a lot of times, either with caregiver abuse or even neglect or self-neglect, you find that there is such a tremendous responsibility from the caregiver part that a lot of times it's just that they may not have the knowledge on how to provide adequate care. They don't understand all of the dynamics that go into maybe that medical diagnosis. And they need services, but they don't have the knowledge to be able to know where to go get those services. So a lot of times, especially in self-neglect instances, when we're able to get in there and talk with the individual, explain to them, give them some good education, good resources, then we find that we're able to assist and help them with that mm-hmm. situation. And a lot of times, the same thing with caregivers as well.
Here's what I heard you say, and mm-hmm. I don't know that this is the real answer to the question. The question was, is it being perpetrated out of malice or out of frustration? And what I heard you say more often than not, it's out of frustration and somebody not understanding what's available to them. If they knew it, they wouldn't be as frustrated, and therefore the abuse wouldn't exist. That's true.
Yes, that is correct.
Would you agree with that?
In some cases, when it's mm-hmm. caregiver neglect, I would absolutely agree. In other cases where it moves into more of an abuse setting, I think that there's more there than simply caregiver frustration.
Mm-hmm. And who are the perpetrators when it is abuse with malice aforethought? Who are the perpetrators?
Overwhelmingly, it's family members, sadly.
Really? You work with elderly clients legally, Shizia, and their families on a number of issues. How many elder adults that you work with are victims of abuse?
Fortunately, many clients come to us in different ways, and we can kind of intervene or make referrals and prevent or minimize. But we get a lot of cases that come to us in different ways. For example, I had one of the first ones I dealt with was a woman who was being evicted. She'd received an eviction notice for failure to pay rent, and I'm supposed to prevent this,
right.
Make a legal argument. And I asked her, well, why didn't you pay your rent? And the reason really was an acquaintance of the family was running a check fraud scam, got her to deposit a fake check in her account and deposit it in the ATM overnight, go to the bank branch the next morning, get the cash out, and then when her rent check comes due, the check bounces. And so now she's in trouble. She's on a fixed income. She has no way to recover from this incident. So we get quite a lot of cases that the client comes to us believing they have a different legal problem, but mm-hmm. some type of abuse is perhaps at the root.
So are most of the cases that you deal with, that when abuse rears its ugly head,
mm-hmm.
are they mostly financial, or are there physical and mental cases of abuse that you uncover somehow in the course of dealing with an older adult?
I would say most of the time we see the financial.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, again, once financial abuse of some kind has occurred, whether it's a crime of opportunity where someone was just sort of in the wrong place at the wrong time and got targeted, or it's more desperation. There's a family member who's been persuaded to, you know, come in and help and live there and now is taking advantage of the situation. Or it's more of a predatory nature. They're, you know, being scammed by some sort of fraudulent scheme. No, it's often financial. And then because the finances are now in chaos, mm-hmm. other problems are developing. Right. And we'll see that too.
So around the state, what types of abuse seem to be more prevalent?
Well, basically at this point, neglect would be your largest number of types of things or mistreatment that's reported.
And when you say neglect, and I'll let you finish the first
okay.
question too, but when you say neglect, is that somebody, a caregiver, actually neglecting their duties as a caregiver, or simply there is no caregiver and the family is detached from the person and they don't check in on a regular basis? What are we talking about?
Could be a little bit of both. Basically, it could be caregiver neglect. Say, for instance, the caregiver is needs to be giving this their family member medication on a regular mm-hmm. basis. Mm-hmm. and for some reason the caregiver has decided not to do that. Say the client is diabetic, so they're not giving them their insulin or those types of things. Or they need to, the individual is bedbound, confined to the bed, and they need to be turning this person often to prevent bed sores. And we go in and we find out that in this instance, the individual does have bed sores, so the caregiver isn't giving them proper nutrition or turning them when they need to be. It also could be self-neglect in that the individual has diabetes, but because maybe they don't understand maybe they have a sight problem and they're not able to draw up their insulin needles. So therefore they're not getting their insulin the way they need to. That would be what we would consider self-neglect.
So what other kinds of neglect are prevalent through the state? Getting back to that other question.
Well, we basically category is caregiver or self-neglect, okay? Then as far as abuse, basically we look from our standpoint as caregiver abuse. And that is when an individual needs to be provided care from an individual and they're physically abusing them, causing them to have bruises or just not doing what they were, having violence. Or that could be verbal abuse as well or mental abuse.
Lori?
I would just chime in to say that it's hard a lot of times to understand the difference between abuse and neglect. Mm-hmm. And the way that I often will describe that is abuse is an action that the perpetrator takes to harm the individual in some way. That can be physically, that can be emotionally, sexually, psychologically. It causes harm to that person, and it's a choice they make to take an action to do that. Mm-hmm. Neglect is almost the opposite. It's choosing to not take an action that person needs to be well and happy, to not provide medication,
right,
warm clothes, a shelter over that person's head. So they're almost opposites, but they have equally devastating effects.
And how often does which seems to be more prevalent?
Neglect is more prevalent.
Experts, and you said this a little while ago, that this is really underreported, and that one expert said it was grossly underreported, that they estimate for every case that is reported, 5 go unreported. One study says that only 1 in 14 cases of elder abuse ever comes to the attention of authorities. Why is it so underreported?
In so many cases, the individual who is mistreating the elder adult is the one thing keeping that elder adult from being placed in a nursing home setting.
So elder adult doesn't want to report it because they know what the consequences of reporting that will be. There's nobody else to take care of them.
They fear that dependence is so great on that caregiver that they are willing to put up with sometimes, or they don't know what their alternatives might be.
Does this happen? Go ahead.
I think seniors also sometimes really feel a lot of shame and embarrassment that somehow, especially when it's a family member, that's the person that was supposed to help them and trust them, and maybe they raised this person, has turned out to be the one that's causing them harm, and they want to save themselves the shame or the embarrassment. They're worried about being placed in some sort of more organized caregiver setting. And they don't want to get that person in trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't want to put their son, their daughter, their grandchild, or their nephew, their niece in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And maybe they're isolated and lonely anyway, and this may be the only company that they have.
We're talking about elder abuse with Shazia Keller, who is a staff attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina. Lori Abinader, a regional ombudsman with the Central Atlanta Area Agency on Aging, and Kathy Maurer with Adult and Aging Services with the Cabarrus County Department of Human Services. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details at GoGarageDoorGuru.com. And Carolina Actors Studio Theater's 20th anniversary season, Flex Pass includes Angels in America and A Tuna Christmas. Details at NCCast.com or 704-455-8542. Hurricane season just started, and already there's been a tropical storm that dropped a lot of rain on Florida and over us this past weekend. Experts say this season will most likely be more active than in the past, but how do they know? How do they make those predictions? We've invited some of Charlotte's leading meteorologists to join us to tell us that and more tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, what's private in the modern age? Government collection of personal data, cyber theft, and the balance between privacy and security.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. In advance of Cabarrus County World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, which is Wednesday, June 12th, there'll be an event at CMC Northeast Medical Center in the Hamrick Theater and Roper Commons from 9 to 3 that day to get information about our topic today, which is senior abuse. We're talking about that with Kathy Maurer, Laurie Abinader, and Shazia Keller. Does this kind of abuse occur in all socioeconomic groups?
Yes, sir, it does.
So you don't have to be poor. You can be rich, and this happens. Where does this most often occur? Is this in the elder person's home or in the caregiver's home? Where does this usually happen?
More often in the home setting. There certainly are instances where it happens in institutional care, in your nursing homes, assisted livings, but overwhelmingly it would be more so in the home setting.
So this does happen in professional settings as well, where the caregivers, the professional caregivers, sometimes abuse patients.
The benefit there is that there are many other professional caregivers who are keeping watch, who have been trained on the right way to provide care, who will often report that and should report that as quickly as possible to make sure that it's investigated.
Does abuse, whether it's emotional or physical or financial, occur more often with those who are suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's or some physical problem like being confined to a wheelchair? Or is it just open season, period?
I think basically it's really no respecter of what that individual is. We see it where individuals who have some dementia, it's occurring there. We also find individuals that they're alert and oriented and they still are having some issues in the home.
Mm. All right, I'm going to put your headphones on. I'm going to bring a caller into this conversation. Mark, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I've got two questions, more legal. The first one is... there's a resource that appears to be for children and then the elderly. What about the individuals that are kind of in between 30s, 40s, early 50s? And is there a way through a durable power of attorney to recover monies if an individual has been financially exploited versus having them ruled incompetent through a guardian system?
Well, I think, as I understand your question, you know, crimes are crimes regardless of age. We're talking about elder abuse because as people get older, due to health problems, due to cognitive problems, they're more likely to be targets. A durable power of attorney is a great tool, and I see this a lot in my practice. It is a great tool for avoiding having to go to the guardianship route. And actually, there's two types of power of attorney. One is over healthcare. One is over financial matters. And a well-thought-out, well-considered power of attorney is a great protective measure to take because if you choose the person who's going to be performing your duties, that's called the attorney in fact. If you choose the person who's going to be performing the financial tasks well, who honors their fiduciary duty to you, then there's a lot of protection from falling victim to abuse. And a good healthcare power of attorney also helps because then caregivers, you can put in provisions to have a caregiver screened or background checks or, and, you know, you've got someone kind of looking out for you to hire and fire someone who's not performing their jobs well. As far as recovering monies, you know, whoever is your attorney, in fact, anything that they perform that is not within the scope of the power of attorney, they are personally liable for their wrongdoing and are supposed to pay you back. Unfortunately, that has to get litigated sometimes to try to get the money back. And sometimes, unfortunately, getting a judgment and getting the money back are two very different things.
And aren't powers of attorney where sometimes people get themselves into trouble, particularly if they don't choose the power, the attorney, in fact, as wisely as they perhaps could or should? Or if that person who is acting as the attorney, in fact, gets themselves into a financial trouble and they see a way out through illegal use of funds. I mean,
absolutely.
It's difficult. It's sometimes difficult to deal with that, isn't it, legally?
It is very difficult to deal with that. And, you know, in my practice, the number one thing that I see that causes me concern is clients come in and they say, oh, I already have my financial power of attorney in place. And I ask to see it. I ask them about the circumstances. My child downloaded this off the internet and I just signed it. And they don't necessarily understand what they have authorized. And it's a real cause of alarm when there's powers in there to sell homes, mm-hmm. sell real estate, to open lines of credit, or self-dealing, which is, okay, mom, I'm going to buy your house from you, you know. And so I think it's very important to meet with a professional, an attorney, and really understand what kind of help you think you're going to need and what you want the power of attorney to do. And the key to having a successful power of attorney document is who you choose as your attorney, in fact. Choosing, I get so many clients who want to choose a child or a spouse because they don't want to hurt their feelings. But I always tell them, if they've never managed money well themselves, they're not going to manage yours well. They may start viewing you as a way out if they have problems. And, you know, financial exploitation is probably the most studied aspect of elder abuse. There's other forms. It's the most studied, and a large number is perpetrated by family members by abusing a power of attorney.
We're going to talk a lot about financial abuse here in this hour. Does that answer your question, Mark?
It does, and I appreciate the answers. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Are powers of attorney revocable on the part of the person who originally signed over that right to someone else?
They are revocable. The person who signed it, that's called the principal, mm-hmm. does need to be in their right mind still in order to revoke.
And who determines that?
It's usually a one-on-one meeting with the attorney, and the attorney is just making an assessment of, does this person seem to understand what they're talking about, the consequences of their actions, the risks, the benefits, and are they able to make a rational decision? When I feel like I'm not sure, sometimes I'll ask the person's neurologist to give an opinion because I don't want to take a chance. And then in order to do a proper revocation, and oftentimes people aren't aware of this, you have to give notice to whoever you gave power of attorney to. You can't just sign a paper saying I revoke, stick it in the drawer in your desk, and assume it's revoked. You have to give notice to the person that was your attorney, in fact, so they know they're no longer authorized. And I think it's a good practice, whatever businesses that were honoring it, I think it's a good practice to let them know, I've revoked this, here's a copy.
Wouldn't that almost be mandatory to deal with your bank and your creditors to say that this person no longer has a right to act in my behalf? I mean, if you don't do that with your bank particularly, how are they supposed to know that this person can't make withdrawals?
Well, when you do a revocation, it gets filed at the Register of Deeds office. But as a practical matter, and as a self-protective, proactive measure, I think the first thing you should do once you file it is go straight to the bank or any other place where you feel vulnerable and let them know, because waiting for word to filter out, a lot of damage can be done while that's happening.
What kinds of financial exploitation have you seen in your practice?
What I see most often is a family member was going to come live because they lost their job, they needed some help for a temporary period of time. That has now turned into several years. Maybe the senior's health has declined during that time as well. And either some of my clients receive food stamps and the food stamps benefit is being misused in some way, Checks are being written, bills are being made out not on time or not in full because the money is being diverted to some other purpose.
It's the Central Atlanta Area Agency on Aging. Do you folks deal with South Carolina as well as North Carolina?
No, we do not.
Okay. So between your territory and that of Kathy Maurer with Cabarrus County, how prevalent is financial abuse versus physical or emotional or psychological or the abuse or neglect?
Well, basically, we're finding out that financial abuse at this point, exploitation, is increasing.
Is that because of the recession, because of unemployment?
We think so. Just year to date in North Carolina, it's 2,152, and that's what has been reported. And as we said earlier, a lot of those things go unreported.
Mm-hmm. What about in from your territory that you cover?
We in our region includes Cabarrus County and mm-hmm. eight other counties.
Okay.
We have Mecklenburg and then the eight surrounding counties.
Okay.
In that area. So I would agree that that trend absolutely is there.
In 2008, it was reported that financial exploitation was the most common form of elder abuse that was, in fact, reported. Mecklenburg County social workers calculated $1.6 million in losses from cases of financial exploitation that they actually investigated, and that was 5 years ago. Worse today is what you're telling us.
Absolutely.
According to an article in The Observer back in 2008, a juvenile caught shoplifting a candy bar may face more consequences than a thief who liquidates his grandmother's entire life savings. And there are similar instances of that around the country. Why?
Part of that is the entire reason that we're here and that we're hosting this event on Wednesday is to increase public awareness about the problem of abuse, all the types of abuses. It has not been elder abuse has not received the attention that it needs on a national scale for us to be able to respond to it. And that's banking industries, legal industries, aging industries, you name it, any agency that works in the human services sector. We have not responded to the problem of elder abuse.
Why not?
In comparison to perhaps the way we've responded to child abuse in the last 20 or 30 years, we've come light years. We've responded to domestic violence. Elder abuse is the last one that we have not gotten there yet as far as our national response being coordinated in our efforts to fight this problem.
Why not?
I think the judicial system has made a lot of progress but still has a ways to go in terms of civil actions or criminal prosecutions against perpetrators. And, you know, there's multiple reasons for that. I think we talked about it earlier. Seniors are just reluctant to report for a variety of reasons. I think also just access to justice can be a little bit more of an issue for seniors. And again, I think our courts have made a lot of progress, but there's still room for improvement. You know, if you're a senior and you have mobility issues, getting to court can be a problem. If you've been diagnosed or have an undiagnosed cognitive impairment, you'll have a hard time filling out forms to launch a case. Going to court sometimes means waiting around on a long docket, waiting for your turn. They may be frail. They may be homebound. They maybe cannot testify at all, or they may be able to testify, but the structure of how testimony is elicited isn't going to work for a senior who has impairments. They need leeway. They need special technique to elicit the testimony. And I think also, and this maybe makes seniors more targets, sometimes unfortunately, the numbers, the timing is not in their favor. If you're already at an advanced age, you may pass away before the court system can get you through the resolution of a case. And I think also as professionals, I think we all struggle with where is the free will end and intervention is needed. The legal system really is balancing an individual's right to make their decisions, even if they're poor decisions, and and are they being abused, and where does the intervention start?
We've talked a lot about spousal abuse on this program over the mm-hmm. years, and it used to be that the law enforcement community kind of turned a blind eye to it because that's a family. It was considered to be a family issue, something that we're not going to involve ourselves. So they'll settle that inside the home. And a lot of times women would not report the crime because a man was their only source of support. It sounds very familiar to what we're talking about here. Does law enforcement take a similar approach today to elder abuse? Do they turn a blind eye to it because that's a family issue? Are we still in the dark ages like we were 15, 20 years ago with the spousal abuse?
I believe we're coming out of the light. I believe that...
Coming into the light,
yes, I'm sorry. We have law enforcement who sits on our Elder Abuse Task Force in Cabarrus County. I have gotten to know several law enforcement agents who have gone and received special training on how to enforce, how to investigate financial abuse. Kathy's agency probably works with law enforcement quite a bit more than I do, but I see more and more interest in getting trained, getting the information mm-hmm. to be able to prosecute this crime.
I would say basically all of the law enforcement agencies in Cabarrus County are very cognitive of the fact that if there are issues that they identify in a home that they go to, even our emergency management services, then they are open to communicating to us at our agency, letting us know what their concerns are, and then we'd be able to respond to those concerns.
And I read some over the weekend that said a lot of the problems with this, and I don't know how true this is, maybe you can shed some light on this, have to do with ageism, a lower regard for the elderly in our society, because they scare us. They remind us of our own mortality, mm-hmm. and so we just don't want to look in that direction many times. How much of it has to do with that?
I don't know. I think probably that is the fact. I think a lot of times we see that family want to be involved, but due to distance or location, that makes it difficult for them if they're maybe caring for a family member and they're out of state. They don't know what the resources here are. And I think we do need to move toward valuing our elder population more than we maybe do. They have a lot of knowledge that we could take advantage of and would be an asset to us.
But I would absolutely agree. And to put to a framework of ageism, of all of the federal dollars that are spent to fight the different types of abuses, only 2% mm-hmm. goes to elder abuse.
Why?
In our federal, exactly what you said. We don't have that value system that older adults in our society are valuable members.
Is it their fault? Because they were the young people that would have made those laws when they were younger, and they didn't. And do we blame them? Do we point the finger of blame at them themselves? And will that change as more and more baby boomers who have affected society since their birth age into the elder population? Will they then demand that these things be taken care of?
The baby boomers have changed everything else, so I think we'll see that continue in a good way. As to the reason behind the ageism that we see in our society, the understanding that I have gathered over the years has more to do with the idea that if you are a working, contributing person to this economy, mm-hmm. then you are valuable. And at the point that you're no longer working and contributing, that's where that shift starts to happen.
Wow. All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our conversation about elder abuse, what's being done about it, and how to spot it, and what you should do if you think you have spotted it when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Billy Graham Library, presenting Rooted in Prayer, Biblical Truths for Everyday Living. The exhibit presents a closer look at teachings and examples of prayer now through June 30th. Details available at billygrahamlibrary.org. And the Rabin Law Firm, representing individuals who bring legal actions under the False Claims Act and related whistleblower laws to expose fraud against the federal and state governments. Details at usfraudattorneys.com. What's private in the modern age? Government collection of personal data, cyber theft, and the balance between privacy and security, the topic of the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock in about 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
The stories you want.
Imitation is the sincerest form of television.
The economy.
The gloves came off.
This is not a victory.
Often food aid gets there after everyone's dead.
When you want them.
Let me state this as directly as possible.
Listen all day, every day. NPR News, always on.
NPR News, plus local and regional news all day on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about elder abuse with Kathy Maurer, Adult and Aging Services Program Administrator with Cabarrus County's Department of Human Services, Larry Abinader, a Regional Ombudsman with the Central Atlanta Area Agency on Aging, and Shazia Keller, a Staff Attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina. Up in Cabarrus County, they'll be having an elder abuse awareness event Wednesday at CMC Northeast Medical Center from 9 until 3, where you can learn more about this and talk more about this. Off the air, you were talking about this tidal wave of older people that has begun to hit the system, and that this has almost come out of nowhere and caught people like yourselves and people who would monitor these abuse claims unawares. We're facing the reason there's more rising financial abuse is because the people who are becoming elderly are the generation that knew how to and did, in fact, save. And their offspring did not save and did not know how to save. And so they've gotten themselves into trouble, and quite often they see mom and dad as a bank. Is that putting it correctly?
I think that's a fair statement. I think the change in demographics, we were talking earlier about, is it the elders' fault that laws aren't in place or political will is not in place to fund studying the problem and finding ways to resolve it? But I think maybe that's in part because, you know, people started retiring and reaching this age and becoming victims in ways that people, as a society, we just weren't focused on that. And now it's here and it's on us, and now we're all forming these creative ways to work around the fact that there is no money. This event that we're putting on Wednesday was done with no money. Everybody's donating their time, donating the space, donating their resources to get it done. And it's because I think we all just were, as Laurie said earlier, the focus was more on child abuse, elder abuse, other issues that we may be dealing with as a society. And we need to be paying attention to this as well, because as you said earlier, Mike, sooner or later, if we have life, we may be facing it ourselves, and hopefully we've got a system in place to protect ourselves.
Where there is financial abuse, more often than not, do other forms of abuse follow? Or is it the other way around?
Very often you will find that there are additional issues that go. If one type of abuse is happening, then others may also be co-occurring. Not always. Sometimes it is just a straight financial abuse. Other times it's just a straight psychological abuse. Mm-hmm. But very often you'll see or hear from a client that there is that co-occurring issue.
Is financial abuse difficult to determine? I mean, if you are the attorney, in fact, under a power of attorney, do you not have to keep meticulous records of how you spend that person's money and what you do with their possessions and their real estate and et cetera?
Yes, you are required to keep a record, keep an accounting. And I encourage my clients, there is the potential and the ability to have these accountings filed with the clerk of court, especially after incompetence. And what I find is clients are often not wanting to require that of their attorney, in fact.
Why?
I think it becomes an issue of balancing convenience for the attorney, in fact, and protection for the person signing the document conferring the power. They don't want to inconvenience and make it harder and make it stressful on whoever they're giving attorney in fact to. And so for the sake of making it convenient and easy, they're making themselves vulnerable.
But from an attorney's standpoint, would you say that if you are a person willing to sign a power of attorney document, mm-hmm. giving somebody else the right to exercise control over your financial situation, that they should have another party oversee the party you've given attorney in fact to?
I think it often, yes, especially if there's going to be any sort of gifts given, especially if there's going to be any real estate that needs to be dealt with, or if there's going to be any activity that is beyond just paying, you know, taking the check, depositing it, and paying up some bills. When it's bigger issues that are harder to recover from, I think it's important to have some sort of checks or balances in place. And what you'll see commonly is clients are just reluctant to do that because they're looking for convenience for the other person, and we really need to get seniors educated on the importance of self-protection, because once the damage is done, getting it undone is a real yeah. bear of a problem.
Maybe they would be less reluctant to take safeguards if they knew about the MetLife study that was conducted a couple yeah. of years ago. The annual financial loss, according to this study, the annual financial loss by victims of elder financial abuse is at least $2.9 billion. That's a B, $2.9 billion. They call this the crime of the 21st century. Now, that was written prior to the passage of the Elder Justice Act of 2010. Has that act had an impact on investigation or prosecution? Has it become more aggressive because of that act? Or is that act just out there doing nothing?
The Elder Justice Act has never been appropriated. The act was passed, but no appropriations have matched it to be able to go into effect. What we have seen is an increased with awareness. We're seeing more and more awareness and events like this coming week with World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more and more of that, but until the appropriations follow the Elder Justice Act, I don't know that we'll see that much of a benefit
from it. The MetLife study also reports that women were twice as likely as men to be victims, and that nearly 60% of the perpetrators were men between 30 and 59. Women perpetrators were younger than that. How do you explain that?
I would might say that your older ladies might feel, might find themselves in a relationship with a younger gentleman. And that might account for some of those statistics, in that, you know, they maybe are widowed, and so therefore this younger gentleman starts to pay attention, and as a part of that, you know, finances become something that he wants to avail himself of, and she more readily will do that because he is someone that's paying attention and showing concern for her, and that may be part of what those statistics are showing.
And it's common to see clients who, of this generation, they let, especially when they're a widow, they let the husband deal with the money, deal with the investing, and they're just not as familiar
right.
and more likely to be trusting.
Put your headphones back on. We'll hear from Tom in York, South Carolina. Tom, welcome.
Good morning. Now, what I'm going to tell you is a true story that is currently going on. What advice would you have for the friends? By friends, I mean 40 and 50 years, that know a woman who is currently 95, who absolutely has refused to sign any power of attorney to family members for the fear of them coming in and taking everything, and who is now in need of someone to assist with financial affairs. She pays some bills twice, other bills she doesn't pay at all. She totally refuses to have electronic deposit of things like pension and dividend checks and interest checks. She has to receive the check and sign it and give it to a caregiver to take to the bank. God knows what they're doing with it. And she just refuses to get help. And she's beginning to drift into a little bit of dementia. She's remarkably cognitive for 95, but she forgets, you know, she loses things. science checks multiple times, you know. And
so, so what do you do for somebody like this? This is probably not an unusual story out there. This is probably going on a lot. So what do you do if they're an adult? They've been an adult for a long time. You can't force them to do things, can you?
No, they have the capacity to do and consent to what they need and what they want to do. My suggestion would be possibly, it sounds like that she would not be open to having a social worker come in and work with her.
Is that the case, Tom?
I'm sure she would not be open to having anybody come in and work with her on anything.
Okay.
Okay.
She refuses.
It may be at this point, because you say that she does have some beginning signs of dementia, that what I would recommend, that you would possibly want to make an adult protective service complaint to the county in which she resides. I would feel that that is how it's done in South Carolina as it is in North Carolina. What they can do is, of course, that can be one of those things where when they start looking at the complaint, even if they feel like at this point that they do not or cannot be able to get involved, at least that can start maybe a record of those kinds of things. And as she progresses in her mental functioning, continuing to make reports as you go along, if they go in and say, well, we really think at this point that she's not to the point where she lacks capacity to handle her own affairs, but at least that gets her started into the system. I don't want to say system, but at least getting someone involved with her, so that then in the future, if she continues to have more issues and her issues increase, then having contact back with the agency and they can continue to follow from that point. Because it does sound to me like if she's having some starting of dementia now, that this may be something that will increase as her she continues to age.
You don't have to be specific, Tom, but is this a relative?
No, that's it. She's a friend of 40 years.
So if you are a friend and not a relative, and I don't know whether the law is different from state to state, but if you are a friend and not a relative, or an acquaintance and not a relative, or a neighbor who's witnessing this but not a relative and not even a friend necessarily, you just are concerned about this person, what should you do? What can you do? Who listens to you? How do they determine that you're not off base?
In North Carolina, there is a statute that requires everyone who has reason to believe that a disabled adult or an older individual is in need of protection to make a report or to report that information to their local social services department. So for Cabarrus County, you would be calling Cabarrus County Department of Human Services. It's where the county in which that individual resides.
Now, this puts yourself, the person reporting this, it seems to me, they put themselves in some jeopardy here. Because either you're wrong or you're right. And if you're wrong, what happens?
There really isn't anything that happens. Basically, you can make an anonymous report. You do not have to give your name and phone number. The only reason that you would probably want to make or give your name and number is so that if that report is accepted or we have additional questions, we can call you back and get additional information. But if I'm an acquaintance or a neighbor, I really don't want my name out there, but I really have some concerns about that neighbor, I can make an anonymous report. And what you need to do is, in that, you need to make sure you give us the name of that individual or identifying information. You know, sometimes people don't actually know who that person's, what their name is.
So in a case like Tom's, Tom calls.
Yes.
Or makes a report and people become involved.
Right.
Officials start to investigate. If this woman refuses to have her Social Security checks direct deposited and her interest payments direct deposited, and in fact you determine that in fact they are slipping through her fingers and not going into her accounts, what recourse does the state or the county have, really? If she wants to continue doing business the way she's doing it, can they stop that? Do they have a right to stop that?
Basically, what we would look at is we have to first of all consider, once we look at the situation and we do an evaluation of her mental, her physical, all of her different areas of evaluation, once we look at that, if we determine that she has the capacity to consent, then we can go. She can go ahead and do what she wants to do, but we will also offer her services to try to assist her with managing her finances and those things.
Thank you for your call.
May I jump in and say one more thing?
Yes.
In this particular case, my suggestion would be to have a conversation with this individual and explain to her, first of all, we understand and support the idea that you value your independence above all else. Secondly, we are seeing some signs that indicate you might need some help in the future, because so many people do who are at your age. And thirdly, we're here to help and support you, but what we don't want to see is all of your goals taken away. We want to see that independence maximized. So if we can help you find someone who you trust to help make those decisions for you in the coming years, we're here to do that.
Dorland in Asheville writes, are there interventions that banks can take if they suspect shady transactions by a caregiver on the behalf of an elderly person?
Banks do make reports to the various social services agency. We receive them in our agency. So they fall under this same North Carolina statute that they are to make reports, and they do.
The government seems to study everything, but they haven't studied this. They haven't conducted very many studies on elder abuse and neglect. And according to the National Center on Elder Abuse of the Administration on Aging, we simply do not know for certain how many people are suffering from elder abuse and neglect. I'm just curious as to why. Why hasn't the AARP studied this? No one knows. Okay. That's fine. You don't have to know the answers to every question. What happens at this 9-3 event at Caparis, at the Elder Abuse Awareness event on Wednesday? What happens quickly?
Basically, we try to let folks know how to make reports if they have concerns. We also are trying to make the public aware, especially our older individuals, how the court system works.
Okay. And more. That's Kathy Maurer with Cabarrus County's Department of Human Services. Laurie Abinader is also with us, Regional Ombudsman with Central Atlanta Area Agency on Aging, and Jazia Keller, Staff Attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina. Thank you for the hour.